John Koskinen is the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. It is good to see you again. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it very much.
Delighted to be here.
You have spoken about the workforce issue at the Internal Revenue Service on a number of occasions before Congress and to other groups. You have completed a tour now of the 25 largest IRS locations outside of Washington. What have you seen as you've gone to those locations around the country, and what are the employees there telling you, John?
Well, I've been delighted. It is really a terrific workforce. I've now met with and talked to almost 12,000 IRS employees, and I've been impressed by not only the experience and the professionalism, but really the continued dedication to the mission of the agency. They are focused on the impacts of the constraints we're operating under, not so much in terms of how it affects them personally, but their concern is that when we don't have enough people, we can't provide the service to taxpayers that our employees think they deserve and our employees want to be able to provide. Mm-hmm. So it's refreshing in a way after everything that's gone on with federal workers generally over the last 3 or 4 years with shutdowns and furloughs and no pay raises, and then the background noise surrounding the IRS over the last 15 months, to find that level of continued energy and focus on the operations of the agency and, again, as I say, the dedication to the mission.
What's the morale situation that you find as you go to these places? I mean, the workforce could be excused for not being in a high morale situation right now.
Well, I expected that I would find, because of all those factors, more of a morale problem than I did. I've been impressed. I do town halls with frontline employees and town halls with managers at every city I visit. And I've been impressed with their kind of upbeat approach to it. They are concerned about the resource constraints. They worry about their own career opportunities, but in a way that's focused really around the impact on the agency. We have a large number of employees, like a lot of federal agencies, but seem to be almost more here because I meet more of them. I've been in the agency 20, 25, 30 years, so they've made a commitment of their life, certainly their careers, to the agency, and so their focus is really on trying to make sure that the agency is able to continue to deliver its services and its mission as effectively as possible.
Mm-hmm. When you do those town halls, we'll start with the employees first. What are the kinds of things that you tell them, and what are the kinds of feedback that you get? Are there consistent themes in what these employees are asking you?
There are a set of consistent themes. I usually have about an hour and a half, and I talk for 15 or 20 minutes and then answer questions on a no-holds-barred basis, as I tell the employees. It's their chance to harass the IRS commissioner. How often does that happen? The common themes are, across the agency, we don't have enough people anywhere, whether it's in appeals, in revenue agency officers, call centers. We're just down 10,000 employees, and it's reflected everywhere. But they are focused on other issues. The financial constraints have meant that over the last couple of years, we've cut back substantially on training and travel. Many managers haven't seen the people they're managing for over a year. So one of the things we've changed is we're doing more training this year than we've done in the past because, as I tell the employees, even in the private sector, when things get tight, the first thing that often goes is training. And I've always thought that the last thing ought to go is training.
Uh-huh.
We need to continue to invest in the workforce if we expect it to be able to function effectively.
What are the managers telling you when you get into one-on-ones or town halls with them as well?
Well, the managers really are on the same page with the employees. Again, focused on trying to get the work done. It's an amazingly can-do agency. It continues to try to find ways to get as much of the work done as possible to sustain our level of audits and collection activities and at the same time our level of taxpayer services. So they are all focused as much as they can on, okay, what can we do to be more efficient? How do we get the work done? So I have spent some time explaining that at some point we have to quit pretending that we can keep doing more and more with less and less, and that we have to be more candid and straightforward with people that, you kind of get what you pay for.
That's a theme that we've been hearing, do more with less, across the federal government for probably the last 3 or 4 years now. And a lot of folks that I talk to on the program are starting to go where you're going, which is that's not really possible. You were very deliberate in talking to Congress when you first came into office about here are the things we'll be able to continue to do. Here are the things we'll be able to do at a reduced capacity. Here are the things we won't be able to do anymore based on the budget that you've given us. That was at the beginning of the filing season. What do you see now at the end of the filing season as far as how your assessments held up? And as you're starting to formulate a request for the next fiscal year to ask for more, how do you intend to go back and make that case again when it didn't go so well the last time?
Well, ultimately, the budget decision is a decision of the Congress. As I said and told some of them when I met with them privately, we'll play the hand we're dealt. If they ultimately will tell us what the resources are, and I think we have an obligation to tell them what those resources will buy, but also what those resources won't buy. And we have an obligation. We're spending taxpayer money. We have an obligation to be as efficient as we can. And we spend a couple $100 million a year less now than we did 3 or 4 years ago as a result of cutting back on printing, mailing, office space, the usual things you try to become more efficient at. But our budget's been cut by about $900 million, and we're down 10,000 people. And yet we have 7 million more taxpayers, and we're responsible for implementing the Affordable Care Act and the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. So as the budget's gone down, the requirements and the work has gone up, and at some point you hit the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how efficient you are, no matter how dedicated the employees are, there's just a limit to what you can be able to do.
How much of what you're up against do you think is where everybody else in government is, which is we have to shrink because of the overall budget picture? And how much of it is just flat-out political considerations because certain members don't care for the mission of the agency?
Well, that's always hard to tell. I suppose the best people to answer that question would be the people on the Hill.
Sure.
I'm sensitive, having spent several years at OMB, to the issue of the deficit. Clearly, when I was testifying in the Senate Appropriations Committee, they noted the entire government has about $2 billion more for fiscal 15 than 14, and our budget request is $1.2 billion. My response to that was, we're the only agency who gives you back more money than you give us as we go. But I do think clearly that's a limitation and a constraint. Also, there are those who have been opposed to the Affordable Care Act since it was passed in 2010. And we are a major implementer of the back end of the Affordable Care Act, which will take place in the next filing season.
Mm-hmm.
So in fiscal 14, we had $430 million in the budget for implementing the Affordable Care Act, $300 million for IT, and we got zero. So clearly some decision was being made that and maybe if we didn't have the money, we wouldn't be able to make the program work. I've tried to explain to people this is an agency that does statutory mandates, and implementing both the ACA and FATCA are statutory mandates, and whatever else we do, we're going to implement those statutes.
I'd like to ask you about the IT infrastructure. I know you're not the chief information officer, and I know you're not hands-on on the IT status of the agency, but I've seen you speak about where the agency is on a broad basis IT-wise. You have some systems that have been around for a long time, don't you?
We are running applications that were running when John F. Kennedy was president. So when I was doing Y2K, we worried about a shortage of COBOL programmers. We're actually running assembly language, which went before COBOL programming. So one of our concerns is that we're going to pretty soon run out of people who know how to run these systems because nobody wants to learn an ancient programming language.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a kind of one-time issue for them. So we need to improve that, but we've made stunning progress in the last several years. If you go to our website, you can now find out the status of your refund. We had almost 200 million hits already on Where's My Refund. You can actually authenticate yourself and print out previous tax returns and transcripts without having to call. So that helps. We processed we'll process about 150 million tax returns this year, and about over 80% of them will be filed electronically. So there are some stunning things happening, but as I say, and I kid our IT head, we're driving a Model T. It has a great GPS system and a wonderful sound system, and we've rebuilt the engine, but it's still a Model T.
You have the same issues, though, the agency has had historically that other agencies have had. There have been attempts to upgrade in the past that haven't gone so well. If you're able to get the budget, do you have a sense of the approach that you'll take to make sure that this time you're able to do what you need to do to upgrade your IT facilities internally?
Right. I think we have a great track record over the last several years. As I say, the website is transforming it. Mm-hmm. And if we had more money, we'd make it happen faster. We have created now what's called a relational database for the first time, so that you can actually access the data for a taxpayer on a regular basis rather than once a week or once a month. as we go forward. So I think we have established a pretty good track record. I remember the IRS 20 years ago when it didn't have such a good track record in information technology. It's always a challenge in the private sector as well as in the government. But I think we've got a pretty clear vision of where we'd like to go. We'd like taxpayers to be able to deal with the IRS the way they deal with their financial institutions. That is, you have an account, you go online, you can file your information, you can find out all your past information, you can get questions answered, you can communicate with us through email, and it would be more efficient for the taxpayers and much more efficient for the government.
So you referenced 20 years ago. Let's go back about 15 years when you were sitting at OMB as the Deputy Director for Management. What, when you looked at the IRS from the outside at that time, what's different as you sit in the chair today as Commissioner?
Well, I think what's different is, first of all, information technology has moved significantly over the last 20 years. It used to be compatibility of various programs and off-the-shelf software was a major challenge. Systems integrators were a critical part of what happens. Now, compatibility is much easier. You can buy different systems and put them together in a way that you couldn't before. I think the programming language has gotten much simpler. You're beyond COBOL programming and the rest of it, so that it, I think, is much easier to implement. And I think there's certainly in the government a better understanding, which we tried to facilitate when I was at OMB, that to the extent you can, you ought to use off-the-shelf software. You ought to adjust your the way you do the work rather than trying to customize the off-the-shelf software.
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, I think the government does a better job, has a better handle on information technology across the board. But when you do major systems, the critical aspect of it is to make sure you're actually implementing modules that are available every 12 to 18 months rather than the old systems where you started out and 5 years later you flipped the switch and hoped it worked and usually it didn't.
Mm-hmm. That agile approach is something that the administration is pushing all across government. Do you have anything that you are aware of in progress now where you're using that approach?
Well, as I said, we've built this relational database, mm-hmm. and if we got some money, what we would do would be kind of one at a time attack those applications that have been running for 50 or 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And again, our process would be to do that not all at once, but basically take them in modules and be able to have deliverables every 12 to 18 months improvements. We're doing the same thing with identity theft.
Mm-hmm.
We're making modular incremental improvements rather than trying to say, let's just scrap the whole thing and start from scratch. First of all, we don't have the money to do that. But also the modular development, making sure you have deliverables every 12 to 18 months is key to successful IT implementation.
Let's go back to the workforce for a moment. You have spoken in the past about the importance of the relationship with unions and at all of the places that you've been. The National Treasury Employees Union is the main union at the Internal Revenue Service. Colleen Kelly's the leader. She's been very outspoken to Congress about some of the budget issues that you've talked about. What's the relationship like between you and Colleen, not necessarily on a personal level, but and between the IRS as an organization and NTEU as an organization?
Well, I've always felt that if you have the right relationship, working with the unions is a partnership. In fact, when I was at OMB, I was on the National Partnership Council with all the heads of all the major government unions. And so every time I go to a city, in addition to meeting with frontline employees and managers, I meet with the local union president or chapter president. And again, it's been my experience that when you really talk to union leaders, they're ultimately have the same interests the employees have. They want their organization to succeed. Nobody wants to be involved in an agency or an organization that can't do its work. And they want their employees to have the resources they need to be able to get the work done. And that's really what a good manager wants as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had terrific conversations in those every major place I've gone. I knew Colleen somewhat from my earlier incarnations. We meet once in a while. We have a very good relationship. We've had a very successful thus far negotiation. We're negotiating a new 5-year agreement. We've got a couple issues that are yet to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think that it's an important signal to our workforce that the union is not sort of us and them. The union is our partnership in this. They are a vehicle for feedback to us. They allow us to get messages out efficiently. to people where we go. So I'm delighted with the working relationship.
And the feedback that you get from the heads of the locals, very similar to what you're hearing from the managers and the rank-and-file employees?
Very similar. Those who haven't dealt with unions or view them as sort of somehow a negative force out there, I would be surprised. I mean, I thought because of all of the pressure on the workforce that I would get in my union meetings more grievances or complaint issues. And almost without fail, maybe with an exception or two out of the 25 cities, the conversations with the union leadership have been mirrored the conversation with the employees and the managers. And that is the focus on how do we make sure that the agency can deliver on its mission and be as effective as possible.
Mm-hmm. The budget priorities that you establish moving forward, where will the money, if you get it, where will the money go to address some of the issues that you talked about? You've mentioned training and travel as something that's a priority you'd like to reestablish, and you've talked about the information technology systems and the resources you'd like to put toward those challenges. Where else, and what will those allocations look like?
Well, if we had more resources, I made it clear to the appropriators, one of the things we would do is hire more revenue agents and officers. We're down, give or take a little, 5,000 revenue agents, which means we'll do probably over 100,000 fewer audits this year. We also need, we're down several thousand people in our call centers. We need to be able to provide better, more effective taxpayer service. In 2013, our taxpayer service level at the call centers was 63%, which meant almost 40% of the people didn't get through. Our concern, and I've talked about this with the Congress, is that at the levels of funding they're talking about, our customer service level this year is going to be in the low 50%, the lowest in years. That means almost half the people won't be able to get through. And my concern is that enforcement and taxpayer services are two sides of a compliance coin. And the most important thing for everybody to remember is that the vast majority of the money we collect, of the $2.9 trillion we collect every year, comes with voluntary compliance. Most taxpayers are just trying to figure out what do they owe and trying to be compliant about it. If that compliance rate changes by 1%, the government loses $30 billion a year. So people need to be comfortable that we're going to give them all the assistance we can, and we spend a lot of time and resources trying to help taxpayers. But they also need to be comfortable that if you're trying to cut corners, we're likely to show up one day and be unhappy about that.
Mm-hmm.
So as I say, we distinguish between the willing to pay and the unwilling to pay. And if you're trying to be compliant and you have a problem, as I tell people, you don't have to hire somebody off late night TV to contact us. We really are anxious to help you become compliant.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to figure out how not to pay your taxes, then you should understand we're not going to be pleased. As I've said, I'm happy to have us chase you to the end of the earth and throw you in jail. But it's all part of reinforcing the image that people need to have is that everybody's paying their fair share.
I imagine that $30 billion goes both ways. If compliance goes down by 1%, you lose $30 billion. But if it goes up by 1%, you gain $30 billion for the Treasury, is that right?
Yes. As I said at my confirmation hearing, after 20 years in the private sector, I never saw any organization that said, I think I'll take my revenue arm and starve it for funds and just see how it does. And as I said to the Senate appropriators, whether it's $4, $6, or $8 for every dollar we spend that we give back to you, it is clear, nobody disagrees, that we provide more money to the government by far than we get. Our collection activities alone run between $50 and $60 billion a year, which is, 5 to 6 times the agency budget in total. The $2.9 trillion obviously is off the charts. But as I say, it's clear in our collection activities that, as I have said, we're the only major agency operating at the post-sequester level. And I've told the Congress, I don't know who got our $500 million, but I am confident they're not going to give back the government the $2 to $3 billion we would have given if we had that funding. So it's a somewhat odd or bizarre situation where it's clear if we had more funding, we'd provide much more money back to the government. It would be a net win for the government, for the taxpayers. But I haven't been able to make that case yet very successfully.
How much of that do you think is a perception problem among people who don't care that it's John Koskinen, and didn't care that it was Danny Werfel, didn't care that it was any of your predecessors? They just don't like the agency.
Well, I think around the world, nobody loves to pay taxes. Nobody loves the tax collector. I think, in fact, I've spent some time trying to educate the public and the Congress about how much time and resources we spend actually trying to help taxpayers. So our image for a lot of people is, you know, a frightening one. We're going to knock on the door and take your car. And as I say, if you're trying to avoid taxes, we may knock on your door and at some point seize your car. But I think it's important for taxpayers to understand that if they're trying to become compliant, we are very anxious to work with them and help them. So I've somewhat facetiously told the press, it may take me a while to convince the public we're from the IRS and we're here to help you, but we really do spend a lot of time trying to help taxpayers. And I think that's an important image. And when we're collecting and working with our revenue officers and agents, there again, we're trying to make sure that we do that appropriately. But it's in a context in which, as I say, when people are writing their check every year, paying their taxes, and having it withheld, they need to be comfortable and confident that everybody's paying their fair share.
So that you're trying to do that, swimming upstream somewhat, as you came into office, of course, the controversy about the exempt organizations part of the Internal Revenue Service. What kind of impact has that had on your ability to try to present the IRS as an organization that's here to help people?
Well, as I said when I started, and I've tried to make clear all along, the issue of the use of improper criteria for selecting organizations for examination when they're applying to be a social welfare organization was a mistake, and it shouldn't have happened, and it shouldn't happen again. And we've done everything we can to make sure that we've remedied the situation. We took all nine of the recommendations of the Inspector General, and they're being implemented, including training and making sure that we've got the right procedures. Because I do think it's important for every taxpayer to feel comfortable that they're going to get treated fairly, and they're going to get treated the same way every other taxpayer is treated. And so whether they are Democrats, Republicans, Independents, whoever they voted for, whatever organizations they belong to, whatever church they go to, they should be comfortable that if they hear from us, it's because of something in their tax return. And if somebody else had that issue, they'd hear from us as well. Because I do think it's critical that the public have confidence that the IRS is not a political organization. It basically is dealing with everyone across the board fairly. If you call in one place, you're going to get the same answer if you called in someplace else. It's an important message. And so I've always said since I've been here that the issue that got raised by the Inspector General 15 months ago is an important issue. Now, there are six investigations going on, so we may be overly investigating the situation, but I do think, again, we've been supportive. We've been trying to provide information and documents to all of those investigators as quickly as we can, again, with a very antiquated system, because I think it's important for the public for those investigations to come to closure. The IG did an investigation and issued a report in May of 2013, and as I said, we've implemented their recommendations. And I've said several times, I'm looking forward to whatever the reports are, whatever they say. I think it's important for the public to know that they will make their own findings of fact and their recommendations. And I've said, we'll take a look at those recommendations, and wherever appropriate, we'll implement those. But I also think the public is anxious to close the chapter, know what the facts were, what the findings were, and then we all need to move on. But in the meantime, I've had a series of 10 fun-filled hearings in the spring into the summer about it. Having worked 4 years in the Senate, I'm a big believer in the Senate. I'm a big believer in congressional oversight, so I think it's appropriate for Congress to be satisfied that they're getting all the information they've looked for as promptly as we can provide it. I understand the frustration when, in fact, it takes us months rather than minutes or days to do that. But I tell the employees that if we can get the investigations concluded, adopt the recommendations that seem appropriate, then I think we'll be able to move on. As I said, we'll be a little less exciting. I'll perhaps be on Fox News a little less often, but we might be able to then have a little more quiet, peaceful discussions about the budget.
I'm struck by the fact that at pretty much every hearing that I recall since you've been commissioner at which someone from the IRS has spoken, it's been you. Is that on purpose? Is that a strategy that you've taken up?
Well, I do think as the senior executive in the agency responsible for managing and running it as the only political appointee in the management side, the other political appointee is the chief counsel, who's a terrific guy, but not running the 90,000 employees I am, that it is important for me to be responsible and accountable for what happens here. I'm spending a lot of time learning about and dealing with all of the problems and trying to set in motion solutions to those. So I think it's important for me to be available to the Congress and not for it would be difficult to hold me. I also think it's important for career executives not to be spending a lot of their time looking over their shoulders worrying that they're going to have to be called up. The advantage of having one political appointee running the agency is that you have developed a very strong career organization of people dedicated to the agency, and we have a terrific leadership team. But in other agencies where they have any number of political appointees, one of their roles is, in fact, to be the buffer, to testify when there are issues, whatever they might be. So you send the assistant secretary, the undersecretary, the deputy secretary. In most agencies, career people never testify. They may give briefings, as our people do, but they don't testify. And I think here again, I ought to be held accountable. I'm responsible for what goes on. I've told people if there's a problem, it's my problem, and I told the employees we'll all work on it to solve it. And if there's somebody makes a mistake, it's my mistake, and we'll fix it. And the goal is to be quick about that and to be transparent. But again, I'm comfortable that if Congress has questions, I should be able to answer them.
Mm-hmm. It's ironic that the organization that's being accused of being so political right now has the fewest number of political appointees and certainly the smallest percentage of political appointees of any agency in the government.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but that is true. There are not political appointees here. They are, as I say, people who are career made career decisions, and a lot of them have been here for all of their working career.
I noted as I got on the elevator to come up to your office, there's a flyer for someone who's retiring, and they've been here for 35 years. And you've made that a theme throughout your comments in our conversation, and whenever you go out and talk about the agency, that you have folks that have been here for so long. Why do you think that is, especially at an agency that among the broader public is not the most popular?
Well, I've been intrigued about that, especially I have lunch at each place I go with 15 to 20 randomly selected employees, and usually half of them have been with the agency over 20 years. So I've talked with them about their careers, what their plans were, and there are several things that come out. First, people are dedicated to the mission. They understand the critical nature of the work of the IRS, both for the government in terms of the money we collect that runs the place, but also because we touch virtually every American, and they feel that they can provide service. Another interesting thing that comes out is the IRS does a lot of different things, has a lot of different activities. So people have found that they can move from one place to another within the IRS, have a varied career without having to leave the organization. Mm-hmm. So one of my concerns is to make sure we continue to offer employees that variety whenever they would like it. So that it is a major resource for us, but it's, of course, a major challenge, just as it is for most government agencies, a lot of companies, and that is 23-25% of our personnel are eligible to retire tomorrow morning. And one of the themes I hear from our employees is a concern about that in the sense that that's a lot of experience and expertise and mentoring that goes out the door. Mm-hmm. And our employees are trying to figure out, isn't there some way we can capture that expertise before people retire? So one of the challenges we have, particularly with all the focus and background noise, as I call it, is continuing to recruit and retain young people and people in early stages of their careers, because over time they have to be, we have to develop them as the next leaders of the organization and the agency.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I know we're early in the phased retirement effort, OPM now has the final rule out on that. Is that a tool that you expect to be helpful in that way? Because that's one of the reasons, one of the things it was intended for.
I do think it will be helpful. Our employees have been aware of it the way I became aware of it. I'd asked questions about it in two or three different town halls. And their thought, and some of the employees that are thinking about retiring, is that it actually has potential to be a very helpful program because it says you can work half-time and collect half of your retirement, so you're not double-dipping. You'll end up with probably a little less take-home pay. But allows you to phase into retirement, and the requirement in the regs is what we would do anyway, and that is you need to be then spending some portion of that time mentoring people coming along behind you. We have a knowledge management program we're developing where we're going to try to capture as much of the experience and knowledge across the various entities in the IRS as we can. so that we have a more seamless transition. We have a little less anxiety in the employees that when people retire, there's a big gap. Obviously, when somebody with 30 years experience retires, you're going to lose something because somebody younger, less experienced is going to move into the position. But on the other hand, I think that transition can help. Again, there's a financial capacity to that. If you have someone who now is working half-time, there's somebody now in their position, so you have to have the resources to be able to pay them for that half-time mentoring, management, and knowledge management development. And in our situation where we keep shrinking, it'll be a challenge, but that's one that I think we're going to take a hard look at trying to figure out how to use most effectively.
You mentioned the term background noise for what's been going on in the headlines about the agency. Where does that stand in your view? And you said you believe that the American people would like to know what there is to know and move on. You've provided reams and reams and reams of documents to the, I think you said, six investigations that are ongoing right now. What's next in your view for that? It's not going to go away. It's not the investigators, it doesn't appear, intend to move on anytime soon.
Well, they're in various stages. We have, we will, for the tax writing committees, we're getting close to providing them a million pages of documents, which is a lot. I get some indications that at least some of the investigations are nearing a close, and sometime this fall, perhaps in the next few weeks, we'll start to see reports coming out. I've sort of kidded a little bit, trying to remind the investigators, the first report will get a reasonable amount of coverage, the next report will get some coverage, and then the third through sixth reports may not get quite as much attention. To remind them that, you know, it is important for us to come to closure on this. I think the public will be interested in those reports. And so, as I say, just in the conversations I have, I sense that at least two or three of the investigations are going to come to closure with a report. And I think that will be important. That will be an important milestone. And I think, again, once the public is satisfied that there's been thorough investigations, certainly there have been enough of them, and that all the facts are out and that the recommendations are there and they'll have our response to those recommendations beyond what we've already implemented, then I think the public will be ready for us to move on to the next issues. We have any number of issues in the IRS. As I say, we touch everybody and we do deal with everything from corporations to individuals. And so my hope would be that certainly before we get to the end of the year, that we'll have been able to put most of this to rest.
The last issue that came out about this was the Judicial Watch stuff on Friday, and I came away with that just from the cursory understanding I have of how federal agencies in general operate, with the impression that that was kind of ground that had already been plowed. Is that your takeaway as well? That I didn't hear anything that I didn't think I knew already.
No, that's right. It's always, it's a challenge for the media when somebody makes a statement as if something new has been discovered to take the time to try to figure out whether it really is new or not. So the litigants announced that suddenly they had discovered the IRS has backup tapes for disaster recovery, and therefore all of Lois Lerner's emails must be out there somewhere. And as you note, that's been an issue that everybody's known about for the last couple months. We've had hearings, three or four different hearings, about the backup tapes at the IRS and the process for using them and re-recording them and the fact that nobody's been able to find any tapes with any additional Lois Lerner emails on them. So what you had was kind of old news suddenly turned into a new news, as if somebody had figured out, gee, the Lois Lerner emails all exist. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out the Inspector General, for the last couple of months, has been doing an investigation of the crash of Ms. Lerner's hard drive 3 years ago and is nearing, I hope, a conclusion with that as well. And one of the things they've done is taken some of the old backup tapes and reviewed them and put them out to see if they could recover any emails. My position on that has been we provided 67,000 Lois Lerner emails. If somebody could find more of them, that would be terrific, because the uncertainty about, well, what might have been lost is more disturbing for people than if you just knew what they were. Thus far, my understanding is that nobody has found another email in those tapes. So it gets back to part of the challenge for everyone, the Congress, for the media, and us, is to try to keep this on an even keel. And there are important issues that are being discussed, but you know, sometimes they get an exaggerated response to what turns out to be old news.
Well, what was even more striking to me about the Judicial Watch thing was I went back and reread it, and it implied that not the IRS, but the more broadly, the government had some kind of backup, as though there were another layer above and beyond what the individual agency had. And I've been covering the government for a long time, so that was news to me. It was not something I was aware of. It would, I'm sure, make the National Archives very happy.
Right. If there
but
were...
I mean, is there something that I've missed over my career that I don't know about, another layer that's somewhere?
No. That would be new. That would be news if there were some archive out there somewhere that had everybody's records and emails on it. To the best of our knowledge, that doesn't exist. Some have concerned that the NSA may have all sorts of data. Nobody has indicated, though, that they have that there's some secret or unknown or newly discovered backup system. The backup system that we've all been talking about for the last couple of months is the IRS program of saving emails for 6 months, primarily for disaster recovery. If a system goes down, you can recreate those. And then those tapes are used and reused until they get too old, and then they're destroyed. There is no additional backup system that anybody I know is aware of.
When you get through these six investigations, and these are behind you, and you're able to move on, what are the vehicles you'd like to use to go to the American people and say, we really are here as a service organization. We're not here to knock on your door unless we really need to knock on your door. We do want to help you. How do you want to get past that that cultural resistance that people have?
Well, I think ultimately, as the old saying goes, the proof will be in the pudding. We need to prove to people that that's who we are, that that's how we behave, that's how we act. And so we need to continue to get the message out. But I think we get wonderful stories from taxpayers who've been helped, who've been treated well, even in when there have been audits, feel that they got treated fairly and appropriately. And those ripple through the system just the way when somebody behaves improperly it does. And so my hope is, because we have great employees and it's a wonderful workforce, that over time the public will, in fact, see that this is an agency. If you're trying to become compliant, this is an agency trying to help you move in that direction as you go forward. As I say, we'll continue to do audits. It's important for people to understand we're going to do that. But as I've tried to say, some will be Democrats, some will be Republicans, some will have voted for who knows who in the last election. And increasingly people have to understand, but that's not why I got audited. And I think with the passage of time and with our continual stress on that, my hope is that people, whatever their political views are, wherever they are on the political spectrum, will be comfortable that when I hear from the IRS, I'm hearing from them because they have a reasonable question about something in my tax return. It has nothing to do with who I am personally.
Commissioner, those are all the questions I have for you. I appreciate your time very much today.
My pleasure. Nice to see you.
Good to see you.